Chapter 20. Getting out of occupied France was difficult and dangerous. Getting back in, at least for a 20-year-old girl with a ready smile, was easy. Only a few days after her arrival in San Sebastian, and after endless meetings and debriefings, Isabel was on the train bound for Paris again, sitting in one of the wooden banquettes in the third-class carriage, the only seat available on such short notice, watching the Loire Valley pass by. The carriage was freezing cold and packed with loquacious German soldiers and cowed Frenchmen and women who kept their heads down and their hands in their laps. She had a piece of hard cheese and an apple in her handbag, but even though she was hungry, starving, really, she didn't open her bag. She felt conspicuous in her ragged, snagged brown pants and woolen coat. Her cheeks were windburned and scratched, and her lips were chapped and dry. But the real changes were within. The pride of what she'd accomplished in the Pyrenees had changed her, matured her. For the first time in her life, she knew exactly what she wanted to do. She had met with an agent from MI9 and formally set up the escape route. She was their primary contact. They called her the Nightingale. In her handbag, hidden in the lining, were 140,000 francs. Enough to set up safe houses and buy food and clothing for the airmen and the people who dared to house them along the way. She'd given her word to her contact, Ian, codenamed Tuesday, that other airmen would follow. Sending word to Paul, "The Nightingale has sung," was perhaps the proudest moment of her life. It was nearing curfew when she disembarked in Paris. The autumnal city shivered beneath a cold, dark sky. Wind tumbled through the bare trees, clattering the empty flower baskets, ruffling and flapping the awnings. She went out of her way to walk past her old apartment on Avenue de la Bourdonnais, and as she passed it, she felt a wave of longing, she supposed. It was as close to a home as she could remember, and she hadn't stepped inside or seen her father in months. Not since the inception of the escape route. It wasn't safe for them to be together. Instead, she went to the small, dingy apartment that was her most recent home. A mismatched table and chairs, a mattress on the floor, and a broken stove. The rug smelled of the last tenant's tobacco, and the walls were water-stained. At her front door, she paused, glanced around. The street was quiet, dark. She fitted the skeleton key in the lock and gave a little twist. At the click of sound, she sensed danger. Something was wrong, out of place. A shadow where it shouldn't be, a clanking of metal from the bistro next door, abandoned by its owner months ago. She turned slowly around, peered out into the dark, quiet street. Unseen lorries were parked here and there, and a few sad little cafes cast triangles of light onto the sidewalk. Within the glow, soldiers were thin silhouettes, moving back and forth. An air of desertion hung over the once lively neighborhood. Across the street, a lamp stood unlit, a barely darker slash against the night air around it. He was there. She knew it, even though she couldn't see him. She moved down the steps, slowly, her senses alert, taking one cautious step at a time. She was sure she could hear him breathing not far away, watching her. She knew instinctively that he'd been waiting for her to return, worrying. "Gaetan," she said softly, letting her voice be a lure, casting out, trying to catch him.
"You've been following me for months.
Why?" "Nothing." Silence blew in the wind around her, biting and cold.
"Come here,"
she pleaded, tilting her chin. Still nothing.
"Now who isn't ready?"
she said. It hurt, that silence, but she understood it too. With all the risks they were taking, love was probably the most dangerous choice of all. Or maybe she was wrong, and he wasn't here. Had never been here, watching her, waiting for her. Maybe she was just a silly girl longing for a man who didn't want her, standing alone in an empty street. No, he was there. That winter was even worse than the year before. An angry god smote Europe with leaden skies and falling snow, day after day after day. The cold was a cruel addendum to a world already bleak and ugly. Karivaux, like so many small towns in the occupied zone, became an island of despair, cut off from its surroundings. The villagers had limited information about what was going on in the world around them, and no one had time to burrow through propagandist papers looking for truth when surviving took so much effort. All they really knew was that the Nazis had become angrier, meaner, since the Americans had joined the war. On a bleak and freezing pre-dawn morning in early February 1942, when tree limbs snapped and window panes looked like cracked pond ice, Vianne woke early and stared at the deeply pitched ceiling of her bedroom. A headache pounded behind her eyes. She felt sweaty and achy. When she drew in a breath, it burned in her lungs and made her cough. Getting out of bed was not appealing, but neither was starving to death. More and more often this winter, their ration cards were useless. There was simply no food to be had, and no shoes or fabric or leather. Vianne no longer had wood for the stove or money to pay for electricity. With gas so dear, the simple act of bathing became a chore to be endured. She and Sophie slept wrapped together like puppies, beneath a mountain of quilts and blankets. In the past few months, Vianne had begun to burn everything made of wood and to sell her valuables. Now, she was wearing almost every piece of clothing she owned. Flannel pants, underwear she'd knitted herself, an old woolen sweater, a neck scarf, and still she shivered when she left the bed. When her feet hit the floor, she winced at the pain from her chilblains. She grabbed a wool skirt and put it on over her pants. She'd lost so much weight this winter that she had to pin the waist in place. Coughing, she went downstairs. Her breath preceded her in white puffs that disappeared almost instantly. She limped past the guest room door. The captain was gone, and had been for weeks. As much as Vianne hated to admit it, his absences were worse than his appearances these days. At least when he was there, there was food to eat and a fire in the hearth. He refused to let the home be cold. Vianne ate as little of the food he provided as she could. She told herself it was her duty to be hungry. But what mother could let her child suffer? Was Vianne really supposed to let Sophie starve to prove her loyalty to France? In the darkness, she added another pair of holy socks to the two pairs already on her feet. Then she wrapped herself in a blanket and put on the mittens she'd recently knit from an old baby blanket of Sophie's. In the frost-limbed kitchen, she lit an oil lamp and carried it outside, moving slowly, breathing hard as she climbed the slick, icy hillside to the barn. Twice she slipped and fell on the frozen grass. The barn's metal door handle felt burningly cold, even through her heavy mittens. She had to use all of her weight to slide the door open. Inside, she set down the lantern. The idea of moving the car was almost more than she could stand in her weakened state. She took a deep, painful breath, steeled herself, and went to the car. She put it in neutral, then bent down to the bumper and pushed with all of her strength. The car rolled forward slowly, as if in judgment. When the trap door was revealed, she retrieved the oil lamp and climbed slowly down the ladder. In the long, dark months since her firing and the end of her money, she had sold off her family's treasures one by one. A painting to feed the rabbits and chickens through the winter, a Limoges tea set for a sack of flour, silver salt and pepper shakers for a stringy pair of hens. Opening her maman's jewelry box, she stared down into the velvet-lined interior. Not long ago, there had been lots of paste jewelry in here, as well as a few good pieces. Earrings, a filigree silver bracelet, a brooch made of rubies and hammered metal. Only the pearls were left. Vian removed one mitten and reached down for the pearls, scooping them into her palm. They shone in the light, as lustrous as a young woman's skin. They were the last link to her mother, and to their family's heritage. Now Sophie would not wear them on her wedding day, or hand them down to her own daughters.
"But she will eat this winter," Vian said.
She wasn't sure if it was grief that serrated her voice, or sadness, or relief. She was lucky to have something to sell. She gazed down at the pearls, felt their weight in her palm, the way they drew warmth from her body for themselves. For a split second, she saw them glow. Then, grimly, she put the mitten over her hand and climbed back up the ladder. 3 more weeks passed in desolate cold with no sign of Beck. On a frozen late February morning, Vian woke with a pounding headache and a fever. Coughing, she climbed out of bed and shivered, slowly lifting a blanket from the bed. She wrapped it around herself, but it didn't help. She shivered uncontrollably, even though she wore pants and 2 sweaters and 3 pairs of socks. The wind howled outside, clattering against the shutters, rattling the ice-sheened glass beneath the blackout shade. She moved slowly through her morning routine, trying not to breathe too deeply, lest a cough come up from her chest. On chilblained feet that radiated pain with every step, she made Sophie a meager breakfast of watery corn mush. Then the two of them went out into the falling snow. In silence, they trudged to town. Snow fell relentlessly, whitening the road in front of them, coating the trees. The church sat on a small, jutting bit of land at the edge of town, bordered on one side by the river and backed by the limestone walls of the old abbey.
"Maman, are you all right?"
Vian had hunched forward again. She squeezed her daughter's hand, feeling nothing but mitten on mitten. The breath stuttered in her lungs, burned.
"I'm fine." "You should have eaten breakfast."
"I wasn't hungry," Vian said.
"Ha!"
Sophie said, trudging forward through the heavy snow. Vian led Sophie into the chapel. Inside, it was warm enough that they no longer saw their breath. The nave arched gracefully upward, shaped like hands held together in prayer, held in place by graceful wooden beams. Stained glass windows glittered with bits of color. Most of the pews were filled, but no one was talking, not on a day this cold, in a winter this bad. The church bells pealed, and a clanging echoed in the nave, and the giant doors slammed shut, extinguishing what little natural light could make it through the snow. Father Joseph, a kindly old priest who had presided over this church for the whole of Vian's life, stepped up to the pulpit.
"We will pray today for our men who are gone. We will pray that this war does not last much longer. And we will pray for the strength to resist our enemy and stay true to who we are."
This was not the sermon Vian wanted to hear. She had come to church, braved the cold, to be comforted by Father's sermon on this Sunday, to be inspired by words like honor and duty and loyalty. But today, those ideals felt far, far away. How could you hold on to ideals when you were sick and cold and starving? How could she look at her neighbors when she was taking food from the enemy, even as small an amount as it was? Others were hungrier. She was so deep in thought that it took her a moment to realize the service had ended. Vian stood, feeling a wave of dizziness at the motion. She clutched the pew for support.
"Maman?"
"I'm fine."
In the aisle to their left, the parishioners, mostly women, filed past. Each looked as weak and thin and washed out as she felt, wrapped in layers of wool and newsprint. Sophie took Vian's hand and led her toward the wide open double doors. At the threshold, Vian paused, shivering and coughing. She didn't want to go out into the cold, white world again. She stepped over the threshold, where Antoine had carried her after their wedding. No, that was the threshold of Le Jardin. She was confused, and out into the snowstorm. Vian held the heavy-knit scarf around her head, clutching it closed at her throat. Bending forward, angling into the wind, she trudged through the wet, heavy snow. By the time she reached the broken gate in her yard, she was breathing heavily and coughing hard. She stepped around the snow-covered motorcycle with the machine gun-mounted sidecar and went into the orchard of bare branches. He was back, she thought dully. Now Sophie would eat. She was almost to the front door when she felt herself start to fall.
Maman!
She heard Sophie's voice, heard the fear in it, and thought, I'm scaring her. And she regretted it, but her legs were too weak to carry her, and she was tired, so tired. From far away, she heard the door crack open, heard her daughter scream,
Hail Captain!
And then she heard boot heels striking wood. She hit the ground hard, cracked her head on the snow-covered step, and lay there. She thought, I'll rest for a bit. Then I'll get up and make Sophie lunch. But what is there to eat? The next thing she knew, she was floating. No, maybe flying. She couldn't open her eyes. She was so tired and her head hurt, but she could feel herself moving, being rocked.
Antoine, is that you? Are you holding me?
Open the door, someone said. And there was a crack of wood on wood, and then, I'm going to take off her coat. Go get Madame de Champlain, Sophie. Vian felt herself being laid on something soft. A bed. She wet her chapped, dry lips and tried to open her eyes. It took considerable effort and two tries. When she finally managed it, her vision was blurry. Captain Beck was sitting beside her on her bed, in her bedroom. He was holding her hand and leaning forward, his face close to hers. Madame? She felt his warm breath on her face.
Vian!
Rachel said, coming into the room at a run. Captain Beck got to his feet instantly.
She fainted in the snow, Madame, and cracked her head on the step. I carried her up here.
I'm grateful, Rachel said, nodding. I'll take care of her now, Herr Captain.
Beck stood there.
She doesn't eat, he said stiffly. All the food goes to Sophie. I have fought this.
That's motherhood in war, Herr Captain. Now, if you'll excuse me.
She stepped past him and sat down on the bed beside Vian. He stood there another moment, looking flustered, and then he left the room.
So you are giving her everything, Rachel said softly, stroking Vian's damp hair.
What else can I do? Vian said.
Not die, Rachel said. Sophie needs you.
Vian sighed heavily and closed her eyes. She fell into a deep sleep in which she dreamed she was lying on a softness that was acres and acres of black field, sprawled out from her on all sides. She could hear people calling out to her from the darkness, hear them walking toward her, but she had no desire to move. She just slept and slept and slept. When she woke, it was to find herself on her own divan in her living room, with a fire roaring in the grate not far away. She sat up slowly, feeling weak and unsteady.
Sophie?
The guest room door opened, and Captain Beck appeared. He was dressed in flannel pajamas and a woolen cardigan and his jack boots. He said,
Bonsoir, madame,
and smiled.
It is good to have you back.
She was wearing her flannel pants and two sweaters and socks and a knit hat. Who had dressed her?
How long did I sleep?
Just a day.
He walked past her and went into the kitchen. Moments later, he returned with a cup of steaming café au lait and a wedge of blue cheese and piece of ham and a chunk of bread. Saying nothing, he set the food down on the table beside her. She looked at it, her stomach grumbling painfully. Then she looked up at the captain.
You hit your head and could have died.
Vian touched her forehead, felt the bump that was tender.
What happens to Sophie if you die? He asked. Have you considered this?
You were gone so long. There wasn't enough food for both of us.
Eat,
he said, gazing down at her. She didn't want to look away. Her relief at his return shamed her. When she finally did, when she dragged her gaze sideways, she saw the food. She reached out and took the plate in her hands, bringing it toward her. The salty, smoky scent of the ham, combined with the slightly stinky aroma of the cheese, intoxicated her, overwhelmed her better intentions, seduced her so thoroughly that there was no choice to be made. In early March of 1942, spring still felt far away. Last night, the Allies had bombed the hell out of the Renault factory in Boulogne-Billancourt, killing hundreds in the suburb on the outskirts of Paris. It had made the Parisians, Isabel included, jumpy and irritable. The Americans had entered the war with a vengeance. Air raids were a fact of life now. On this cold and rainy evening, Isabel pedaled her bicycle down a muddy, rutted country road in a heavy fog. Rain plastered her hair to her face and blurred her vision. In the mist, sounds were amplified. The cry of a pheasant disturbed by the sucking sound of her wheels in the mud. The near-constant drone of aeroplanes overhead. The lowing of cattle in a field she couldn't see. A woolen hood was her only protection. As if being drawn in charcoal on vellum by an uncertain hand, the demarcation line slowly came into view. She saw coils of barbed wire stretched out on either side of a black and white checkpoint gate. Beside it, a German sentry sat in a chair, his rifle rested across his lap. At Isabel's approach, he stood and pointed the gun at her.
Halt!
She slowed the bike. The wheels stuck in the mud, and she nearly flew from her seat. She dismounted, stepped down into the muck. 500 franc notes were sewn into the lining of her coat, as well as a set of false identity papers for an airman hiding in a safe house nearby. She smiled at the German, walked her bicycle toward him, thumping through muddy potholes.
Documents, he said.
She handed him her forged Juliet papers. He glanced down at them, barely interested. She could tell that he was unhappy to be manning such a quiet border in the rain.
Pass, he said, sounding bored.
She repocketed her papers and climbed back onto her bicycle, pedaling away as quickly as she could on the wet road. An hour and a half later, she reached the outskirts of the small town of Brantôme. Here, in the free zone, there were no German soldiers, although lately the French police had proven to be as dangerous as the Nazis, so she didn't let her guard down. For centuries, the town of Brantôme had been considered a sacred place that could both heal the body and enlighten the soul. After the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War ravaged the countryside, the Benedictine monks built an immense limestone abbey backed by soaring gray cliffs on one side and the wide Drôme River on the other. Across the street from the caves at the end of town was one of the newest safe houses, a secret room tucked into an abandoned mill built on a triangle of land between the caves and the river. The ancient wooden mill turned rhythmically, its buckets and wheel furred with moss. The windows were boarded up, and anti-German graffiti covered the stone walls. Isabel paused in the street, glancing both ways to make sure that no one was watching her. No one was. She locked her bicycle to a tree at the end of town, and then crossed the street and bent down to the cellar door, opening it quietly. All of the doors to the mill house were boarded up, nailed shut. This was the only way inside. She climbed down into the black, musty cellar and reached for the oil lamp she kept on a shelf there. Lighting it, she followed the secret passageway that had once allowed the Benedictine monks to escape from the so-called barbarians. Narrow, steeply pitched stairs led to the kitchen. Opening the door, she slipped into the dusty, cobwebby room and kept going upstairs to the secret 10x10 room built behind one of the old storerooms.
"She's here. Perk up, Perkins."
In the small room, lit only by a single candle, two men got to their feet, stood at attention. Both were dressed as French peasants in ill-fitting clothes.
"Captain Ed Perkins, miss,"
the bigger of the two men said.
"And this here lout is Ian Trufford or some such name. He's Welsh. I'm a Yank. We're both damned happy to see you. We've been going half mad in this small space."
"Only half mad?" she asked.
Water dripped from her hooded cloak and made a puddle around her feet. She wanted nothing more than to crawl into her sleeping bag and go to sleep, but she had business to conduct first.
"Perkins, you say?"
"Yes, miss."
"From?"
"Bend, Oregon, miss. My pa's a plumber and my ma makes the best apple pie in four counties."
"What's the weather like in Bend this time of year?"
"What's this, middle of March? Cold, I guess. Not snowing anymore, maybe, but no sunshine yet."
She bent her neck from side to side, massaging the pain in her shoulders. All this peddling and lying and sleeping on the floor took a toll. She interrogated the two men until she was certain they were who they said they were. Two downed airmen who'd been waiting weeks for their chance to get out of France. When she was finally convinced, she opened her rucksack and brought out supper, such as it was. The three of them sat on a ragged, mouse-eaten carpet on the floor, with the candle set in the middle. She brought out a baguette and a wedge of camembert and a bottle of wine, which they passed around. The Yank, Perkins, talked almost constantly, while the Welshman chewed in silence, saying no thank you to the offer of wine.
"You must have a husband somewhere who is worried about you," Perkins said as she closed her rucksack.
She smiled. Already this had become a common question, especially from the men her age.
"And you must have a wife who is waiting for word," she said.
It was what she always said, a pointed reminder.
"Nah," Perkins said. "Not me. A lug like me don't have girls lining up. And now..."
She frowned.
"Now what?"
"I know it's not exactly heroic to think about, but I could walk out of this boarded-up house in this town I can't fucking pronounce and get shot by some guy I got nothing against. I could die trying to bike across your hills."
"Mountains."
"I could get shot walking into Spain by the Spanish or the Nazis. Hell, I could probably freeze to death in your damned hills."
"Mountains,"
she said again, her gaze steady on his.
"That's not going to happen."
Ian made a sighing sound.
"There, you see, Perkins, this slip of a girl is going to save us."
The Welshman gave her a tired smile.
"I'm glad you're here, miss. This lad's been sending me round the bend with his chatter."
"You might as well let him talk, Ian. By this time tomorrow, it'll take all you have inside to keep breathing."
"The hills?"
Perkins asked, his eyes wide.
"Oui,"
she said, smiling.
"The hills."
Americans, they didn't listen. In late May, spring brought life and color and warmth back to the Loire Valley. Vianne found peace in her garden. Today, as she pulled weeds and planted vegetables, a caravan of lorries and soldiers and Mercedes-Benzes rolled past Le Jardin. In the 5 months since the Americans had joined the war, the Nazis had lost all pretense of politeness. They were always busy now, marching and rallying and gathering at the munitions dump. The Gestapo and the SS were everywhere, looking for saboteurs and resistors. It took nothing to be called a terrorist, just a whispered accusation. The roar of aeroplanes overhead was nearly constant, as were bombings. How often this spring had someone sidled up to Vianne while she was in a queue for food or walking through town or waiting at the post and asked her about the latest BBC broadcast.
"I have no radio. They are not allowed,"
was always her response, and it was true. Still, every time she was asked such a question, she felt a shiver of fear. They had learned a new word, les collabos, the collaborators, French men and women who did the Nazis' dirty work, who spied on friends and neighbors and reported back to the enemy, relaying every infraction, real or imagined. On their word, people had begun to be arrested for little things, and many who were taken to the commandant's office were never seen again.
Madame Mauriac!
Sarah ran through the broken gate and into the yard. She looked frail and too thin, her skin so pale the blood vessels showed through.
You need to help my maman.
Vianne sat back on her heels and pushed the straw hat back on her head.
What's wrong? Did she hear from Mark?
I don't know what's wrong, madame. Maman won't talk. When I told her Ari was hungry and needed changing, she shrugged and said, what does it matter? She's in the backyard just staring at her sewing.
Vianne got to her feet and peeled off her gardening gloves, tucking them into the pocket of her denim overalls. I'll check on her. Get Sophie and we'll all walk over. While Sarah was in the house, Vianne washed her hands and face at the outdoor pump and put away her hat. In its place, she tied a bandana around her head. As soon as the girls were with her, Vianne put her gardening tools in the shed, and the three of them headed next door. When Vianne opened the door, she found 3-year-old Ari asleep on the rug. She scooped him into her arms, kissed his cheek, and turned to the girls.
Why don't you go play in Sarah's room?
She lifted the blackout shade, saw Rachel sitting alone in the backyard.
Is my maman okay?
Sarah asked. Vianne nodded distractedly.
Run along now.
As soon as the girls were in the next room, she took Ari into Rachel's room and put him in his crib. She didn't bother covering him, not on a day this warm. Outside, Rachel was in her favorite wooden chair, seated beneath the chestnut tree. At her feet was her sewing basket. She wore a brown khaki twill jumpsuit and a paisley turban. She was smoking a small brown hand-rolled cigarette. There was a bottle of brandy beside her, and an empty cafe glass.
Rach?
Sarah went for reinforcements, I see.
Vianne moved to stand beside Rachel. She laid a hand on her friend's shoulder. She could feel Rachel trembling.
Is it Mark?
Rachel shook her head.
Thank God.
Rachel reached sideways for the brandy bottle, pouring herself a glass. She drank deeply, emptied the glass, then set it down.
They have passed a new statute, she said at last.
Slowly, she unfurled her left hand to reveal wrinkled bits of yellow cloth that had been cut into the shape of a star. Written on each one was the word Juif in black.
We are to wear these, Rachel said. We have to stitch them onto our clothes, the 3 pieces of outerwear we are allowed, and wear them at all times in public. I had to buy them with my ration cards. Maybe I shouldn't have registered. If we don't wear them, we are subject to severe sanctions, whatever that means.
Vianne sat down in the chair beside her.
But you've seen the posters in town, how they show us Jews as vermin to be swept away and money grubbers who want to own everything. I can handle it. What about Sarah? She'll feel so ashamed. It's hard enough to be 11 without this, Vianne.
Don't do it.
It is immediate arrest if you are caught not wearing it. And they know about me. I've registered. And there's Beck. He knows I'm Jewish.
In the silence that followed, Vianne knew they were both thinking of the arrests that were taking place around Karivaux, of the people who were disappearing.
You could go to the free zone, Vianne said softly. It's only 4 miles away.
A Jew can't get an Ausweis. And if I got caught?
Vianne nodded. It was true. Running was perilous, especially with children. If Rachel were caught crossing the frontier without an Ausweis, she would be arrested or executed.
I'm afraid,
Rachel said. Vian reached over and held her friend's hand. They stared at each other. Vian tried to come up with something to say, a bit of hope to offer, but there was nothing.
It's going to get worse.
Vian was thinking the same thing.
Maman?
Sarah came into the backyard, holding Sophie's hand. The girls looked frightened and confused. They knew how wrong things were these days, and both had learned a new kind of fear. It broke Vian's heart to see how changed these girls had already been by the war. Only 3 years ago, they'd been ordinary children who laughed and played and defied their mothers for fun. Now they moved forward cautiously, as if bombs could be buried beneath their feet. Both were thin, their puberty held at bay by poor nutrition. Sarah's dark hair was still long, but she'd begun to yank it out in her sleep, so there were balding patches here and there, and Sophie never went anywhere without Bebe. The poor pink stuffed animal was beginning to spew stuffing around the house.
Here, Rachel said. Come here.
The girls shuffled forward, holding hands so tightly they appeared fused together. And in a way they were, as were Rachel and Vian, joined by a friendship so strong it was maybe all they had left to believe in. Sarah sat in the chair by Rachel, and Sophie finally let her friend go. She came over to stand by Vian. Rachel looked at Vian. In that single glance, sorrow flowed between them. How could they have to say things like this to their children?
These yellow stars,
Rachel said, opening her fist, revealing the ugly little flower of ragged fabric with its black marking.
We have to wear them on our clothes at all times now.
Sarah frowned.
But why?
We are Jews, Rachel said. And we're proud of that. You have to remember how proud we are of it, even if people...
Nazis,
Vian said more sharply than intended.
Nazis, Rachel added, want to make us feel bad about it.
Will people make fun of me?
Sarah asked, her eyes widening.
I will wear one too, Sophie said.
Sarah looked pathetically hopeful at that. Rachel reached out for her daughter's hand and held it.
No, baby, this is one thing you and your best friend can't do together.
Vian saw Sarah's fear and embarrassment and confusion. She was trying her best to be a good girl, to smile, and be strong even as tears glazed her eyes.
We,
she said at last. It was the saddest sound Vian had heard in nearly 3 years of sorrow. Chapter 21. When summer came to the Loire Valley, it was as hot as the winter had been cold. Vian longed to open her bedroom window to let air in, but not a breeze stirred on this hot late June night. She pushed the damp hair from her face and slumped in her chair by the bed. Sophie made a whimpering sound. In it, Vian heard a muddled, drawn-out,
Maman,
and she dipped her rag into the bowl of water she'd placed on the only remaining nightstand. The water was as warm as everything else in this upstairs room. She twisted the rag over the bowl, watched the excess water fall back into the bowl. Then she placed the wet rag on her daughter's forehead. Sophie muttered something incomprehensible and started to thrash. Vian held her down, whispering love words in her ear, feeling heat against her lips.
Sophie,
she said, the name a prayer with no beginning, no end.
I'm here.
She said it over and over until Sophie calmed again. The fever was getting worse. For days now, Sophie had been ailing, feeling achy and out of sorts. At first, Vian thought it was an excuse to avoid the responsibilities they shared. Gardening, laundry, canning, sewing. Vian was constantly trying to do more, get more done. Even now, in the middle of the summer, she worried about the coming winter. This morning had shown Vian the truth, however, and made her feel like a terrible mother for not seeing it from the start. Sophie was sick, very sick. She had been plagued by fever all day, and her temperature was rising. She hadn't been able to keep anything down, not even the water her body needed so desperately. "How about some lemonade?" she said. No answer. Vian leaned over and kissed Sophie's hot cheek. Dropping the rag back into the bowl full of water, she went downstairs. On the dining room table, a box waited to be filled, her most recent care package to Antoine. She'd started it yesterday and would have finished and mailed it off if not for Sophie's turn for the worse. She was almost at the kitchen when she heard her daughter's scream. Vian ran back up the stairs.
"Maman!"
Sophie croaked, coughing. It was a terrible rattling sound. She thrashed in the bed, yanking at the blankets, trying to shove them away. Vian tried to calm her daughter, but Sophie was a wildcat, twisting and screaming and coughing. If only she had some of Dr. Collis Brown's chlorodyne. It worked magic on a cough, but of course there was none left.
"It's all right, Soph. Maman is here," Vian said soothingly, but her words had no effect.
Beck appeared beside her. She knew she should be angry that he was here, here in her bedroom, but she was too tired and scared to lie to herself.
"I don't know how to help her. There are no aspirin or antibiotics to be had at any price in town."
"Not even for pearls?"
She looked at him in surprise.
"You know I sold my maman's pearls?"
"I live with you," he paused. "I make it my business to know what you are doing."
She didn't know what to say to that. He looked down at Sophie.
"She coughed all night. I could hear it."
Sophie had gone still, frighteningly so.
"She'll get better."
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small bottle of antibiotics.
"Here."
She looked up at him. Was she overstating it to think that he was saving her daughter's life? Or did he want her to think that? She could rationalize what it meant to take food from him. After all, he needed to eat, and it was her job to cook for him. This was a favor, pure and simple, and there would be a price for it.
"Take it,"
he said gently. She took the bottle from him. For a second, they were both holding it. She felt his fingers against hers. Their gazes locked, and something passed between them. A question was asked and answered.
"Thank you,"
she said.
"You are most welcome." "Sir, the Nightingale is here."
The British consul nodded.
"Send her in."
Isabel entered the dark, mahogany-lined office at the end of the elaborate hallway. Before she even reached the desk, the man behind it stood.
"Good to see you again."
She sank into the uncomfortable leather chair and took the glass of brandy he offered. This latest crossing of the Pyrenees had been difficult, even in the perfect July weather. One of the American airmen had had difficulty following a girl's orders and had gone off on his own. They'd gotten word that he'd been arrested by the Spaniards.
"Yanks,"
she said, shaking her head. There was no more that needed to be said. She and her contact, Ian, codename Tuesday, had worked together from the beginning of the Nightingale escape route. With help from Paul's network, they had set up a complex series of safe houses across France and a group of partisans ready to give their lives to help the downed airmen get home. French men and women scanned the skies at night, watching for aeroplanes in trouble and parachutes floating downward. They combed the streets, peering into shadows, looking through barns, seeking Allied soldiers in hiding. Once back in England, the pilots couldn't fly missions again, not with their knowledge of the network. Instead, they prepared their colleagues for the worst, taught them evasion techniques, told them how to find help, and supplied them with franc notes and compasses and photographs ready-made for false papers. Isabel sipped the brandy. Experience had taught her to be cautious with alcohol after the crossing. She was usually more dehydrated than she realized, especially in the heat of summer. Ian pushed an envelope toward her. She took it, counted the franc notes inside, and slid the money into a pocket in her coat.
"That's 87 airmen you've brought us in the past 8 months, Isabel," he said, taking his seat.
Only in this room, one-on-one, did he use her real name. In all official correspondence with MI9, she was the Nightingale. To the other employees of the consulate and in Britain, she was Juliet Gervais.
"I think you should slow down."
"Slow down?"
"The Germans are looking for the Nightingale, Isabel."
"That's old news, Ian."
"They're trying to infiltrate your escape route. Nazis are out there pretending to be downed airmen. If you pick up one of them..."
"We're careful, Ian. You know that. I interrogate every man myself, and the network in Paris is tireless."
"They're looking for the Nightingale. If they find you..."
"They won't."
She got to her feet. He stood too and faced her.
"Be careful, Isabel."
"Always."
He came around the desk and took her by the arm and led her out of the building. She took a little time to enjoy the seaside beauty of San Sebastian, to walk along the path above the crashing white surf below, and enjoy buildings that didn't bear swastikas, but such moments of brushing up to ordinary life were a luxury she couldn't indulge for long. She sent Paul a message via courier that read,
"Dear Uncle, I hope this note finds you well. I am at our favorite place by the sea. Our friends have arrived safely. Tomorrow I shall visit Grand-Mère in Paris at 3 o'clock. Love always, Juliet."
She returned to Paris via a circuitous route. She stopped at each of the safe houses, in Carrevaux and Brantôme and Pau and Poitiers, and paid her helpers. The feeding and clothing of airmen in hiding was no small undertaking, and since every man, woman, and child, mostly women, who maintained the escape route, did so at the risk of their lives, the network strived to make it not ruinous financially, too. She never walked through the streets of Carrevaux, hidden beneath a cloak and hood, without thinking about her sister. Lately, she had begun to miss Vianne and Sophie. Memories of their nights playing belote or checkers by the fire, Vianne teaching Isabel to knit or trying to, and Sophie's laughter had taken on a warm patina. She imagined sometimes that Vianne had offered Isabel a possibility she hadn't seen at the time, a home. But it was too late for that now. Isabel couldn't risk putting Vianne in danger by showing up at Le Jardin. Surely Beck would ask what she'd been doing in Paris for so long. Maybe he would wonder enough to check. In Paris, she exited the train amid a crowd of drab-eyed, dark-clothed people who looked like they belonged in an Edvard Munch painting. As she passed the glittering gold dome of the Invalides, a light fog moved through the streets, plucking color from the trees. Most of the cafes were closed, their chairs and tables stacked beneath tattered awnings. Across the street was the apartment she'd called home for the past month, a dark, squalid, lonely little attic tucked above an abandoned charcuterie. The walls still smelled vaguely of pork and spices. She heard someone yell,
"Halt!"
Whistles shrieked. People screamed. Several Wehrmacht soldiers, accompanied by French policemen, encircled a small group of people, who immediately dropped to their knees and raised their arms. She saw yellow stars on their chests. Isabel slowed. Anouk appeared beside her, linking her arm through Isabel's.
"Bonjour,"
she said in a voice so animated it alerted Isabel to the fact that they were being watched, or at least Anouk worried that they were.
"You are like a character in one of those American comics, the way you appear and disappear. The Shadow, perhaps."
Anouk smiled.
"And how was your latest holiday in the mountains?"
"Unremarkable."
Anouk leaned close.
"We hear word of something being planned. The Germans are recruiting women for clerical work on Sunday night. Double pay. All very secretive."
Isabel slipped the envelope full of franc notes from her pocket and handed it to Anouk, who dropped it into her open handbag.
"Night work? And clerical?"
"Paul has gotten you a position," Anouk said. "You start at 9. When you are finished,
Go to your father's apartment. He will be waiting for you.
Oui.
It might be dangerous.
Isabel shrugged.
What isn't?
That night, Isabel walked across town to the prefecture of police. There was a hum in the pavement beneath her feet. The sound of vehicles moving somewhere close by. A lot of them.
You there!
Isabel stopped, smiled. A German walked up to her, his rifle at the ready. His gaze dropped to her chest, looking for a yellow star.
I am to work tonight, she said,
indicating the prefecture of police building in front of her. Although the windows were blacked out, the place was busy. There were German Wehrmacht officers and French gendarmes milling about, going in and out of the building, which was an oddity at this late hour. In the courtyard was a long row of buses parked end to end. The drivers stood together in a huddle, smoking and talking. The policeman cocked his head.
Go.
Isabel clutched the collar of her drab brown coat. Although it was warm out, she didn't want to draw attention to herself tonight. One of the best ways to disappear in plain sight was to dress like a wren. Brown, brown, and more brown. She had covered her blonde hair with a black scarf, tied in a turban style with a big knot in front, and had used no cosmetics, not even lipstick. She kept her head down as she walked through a throng of men in French police uniforms. Just inside the building, she stopped. It was a huge space with staircases on either side and office doors spaced every few feet. But tonight it looked like a sweatshop, with hundreds of women seated at desks pressed close together. Telephones rang nonstop, and French police officers moved in a rush.
You are here to help with the sorting?
Asked a bored French gendarme at the desk nearest the door.
Oui. I'll find you a place to work. Come with me.
He led her around the perimeter of the room. Desks were spaced so closely together that Isabel had to turn sideways to make her way down the narrow aisle to the empty desk he'd indicated. When she sat down and scooted close, she was elbow to elbow with the women on either side of her. The surface of her desk was covered with card boxes. She opened the first box and saw the stack of cards within. She pulled out the first one and stared at it. Sternholtz, Isaac, 12 Avenue Rast, 4th Arrondissement, Sabotier, Clogmaker. It went on to list his wife and children.
You are to separate the foreign-born Jews, said the gendarme,
whom she hadn't noticed had followed her.
Pardon?
She said, taking out another card. This one was for Bear, Simone.
That box there, the empty one, separate the Jews born in France from those born elsewhere. We are only interested in foreign-born Jews, men, women, and children.
Why?
They're Jews. Who cares? Now get to work.
Isabel turned back around in her seat. She had hundreds of cards in front of her, and there were at least 100 women in this room. The sheer scale of this operation was impossible to comprehend. What could it possibly mean?
How long have you been here?
She asked the woman beside her.
Days, the woman said, opening another box. My children weren't hungry last night for the first time in months.
What are we doing?
The woman shrugged.
I've heard them saying something about Operation Spring Wind.
What does it mean?
I don't want to know.
Isabel flipped through the cards in the box. One near the end stopped her. Lévy, Paul. 61, Rue Blondine, Apartment C, 7th Arrondissement. Professor of Literature. She got to her feet so fast she bumped into the woman beside her, who cursed at the interruption. The cards on her desk slid to the floor in a cascade. Isabel immediately knelt down and gathered them up, daring to stick Monsieur Levy's card up her sleeve. The moment she stood, someone grabbed her by the arm and dragged her down the narrow aisle. She bumped into women all down the row. In the empty space by the wall, she was twisted around and shoved back so hard she slammed into the wall.
What is the meaning of this?
Snarled the French policeman, his grip on her arm tight enough to leave a bruise.
Could he feel the index card beneath her sleeve?
I'm sorry, so sorry. I need to work, but I'm sick, you see. The flu.
She coughed as loudly as she could. Isabel walked past him and left the building. Outside, she kept coughing until she got to the corner. There, she started to run.
What could it mean?
Isabel peered past the blackout shade in the apartment, staring down at the avenue. Papa sat at the dining room table, nervously drumming his ink-stained fingers on the wood. It felt good to be here again, with him, after months away, but she was too agitated to relax and enjoy the homey feel of the place.
You must be mistaken, Isabel,
Papa said, on his second brandy since her return.
You said there had to be tens of thousands of guards. That would be all the Jewish people in Paris, surely.
Question what it means, Papa, but not the facts, she answered. The Germans are collecting the names and addresses of every foreign-born Jewish person in Paris, men, women, and children.
But why? Paul Levy is of Polish descent, it's true, but he has lived here for decades. He fought for France in the Great War. His brother died for France. The Vichy government has assured us that veterans are protected from the Nazis.
Vianne was asked for a list of names, Isabel said. She was asked to write down every Jewish, communist, and Freemason teacher at her school. Afterward, they were all fired.
They can hardly fire them twice.
He finished his drink and poured another.
And it is the French police gathering names. If it were the Germans, it would be different.
Isabel had no answer to that. They had been having this same conversation for at least 3 hours. Now it was edging past 2 in the morning, and neither of them could come up with a credible reason why the Vichy government and the French police were collecting the names and addresses of every foreign-born Jewish person living in Paris. She saw a flash of silver outside. Lifting the shade a little higher, she stared down at the dark street. A row of buses rolled down the avenue, their painted headlamps off, looking like a slow-moving centipede that stretched for blocks. She had seen buses outside of the Prefecture of Police, dozens of them parked in the courtyard.
Papa!
Before she could finish, she heard footsteps coming up the stairs outside of the apartment. A pamphlet of some kind slid into the apartment through the slit beneath the door. Papa left the table and bent to pick it up. He brought it to the table and set it down next to the candle. Isabel stood behind him. Papa looked up at her.
It's a warning. It says the police are going to round up all the foreign-born Jews and deport them to camps in Germany.
We are talking when we need to be acting, Isabel said. We need to hide our friends in the building.
It's so little,
Papa said. His hand was shaking. It made her wonder again, sharply, what he'd seen in the Great War, what he knew that she did not.
It's what we can do, Isabel said. We can make some of them safe, at least for tonight. We'll know more tomorrow.
Safe? And where would that be, Isabel? If the French police are doing this, we are lost.
Isabel had no answer for that. Saying no more, they left the apartment. Stealth was difficult in a building as old as this one, and her father, moving in front of her, had never been light on his feet. Brandy made him even more unsteady as he led her down the narrow, twisting staircase to the apartment directly below theirs. He stumbled twice, cursing his imbalance. He knocked on the door. He waited to the count of 10 and knocked again, harder this time. Very slowly, the door opened, just a crack at first, and then all the way.
Oh, Julien, it is you,
said Ruth Friedman. She was wearing a man's coat over a floor-length nightgown, with her bare feet sticking out beneath. Her hair was in rollers and covered with a scarf.
You've seen the pamphlet?
I got one. Is it true?
She whispered.
I don't know, her father said. There are buses out front, and lorries have been rumbling past all night. Isabel was at the Prefecture of Police tonight, and they were collecting the names and addresses of all foreign-born Jewish people. We think you should bring the children to our place for now. We have a hiding place.
But my husband is a prisoner of war. The Vichy government promises us that we will be protected.
I am not sure we can trust the Vichy government, madame, Isabel said to the woman. Please, just hide for now.
Ruth stood there a moment, her eyes widening. The yellow star on her overcoat was a stark reminder of the way the world had changed. Isabel saw when the woman decided. She turned on her heel and walked out of the room. Less than a minute later, she guided her two daughters toward the door.
What do we bring?
Nothing, Isabel said. She herded the Friedmans up the stairs. When they reached the safety of the apartment, her father led them to the secret room in the back bedroom and closed the door on them.
I'll get the Wisniaks, Isabel said. Don't put the armoire back in place yet.
They're on the third floor, Isabella. You'll never...
Lock the front door behind me. Don't open it unless you hear my voice.
Isabel, no.
She was already gone, running down the stairs, barely touching the banister in her haste. When she was nearly to the third floor landing, she heard voices below. They were coming up the stairs. She was too late. She crouched where she was, hidden by the elevator. Two French policemen stepped onto the landing. The younger of the two knocked twice on the Wisniak's door, waited a second or two, and then kicked it open. Inside, a woman wailed. Isabel crept closer, listening.
"Are Madame Wisniak?" the policeman on the left said. "Your husband is Emile, and your children Anton and Helene?"
Isabel peered around the corner. Madame Wisniak was a beautiful woman, with skin the color of fresh cream, and luxurious hair that never looked as messy as it did now. She was wearing a lacy silk negligee that must have cost a fortune when it was purchased. Her young son and daughter, whom she had pulled in close, were wide-eyed.
"Pack up your things. Just the necessaries. You are being relocated," said the older policeman as he flipped through a list of names.
"But my husband is in prison near Pithiviers. How will he find us?"
"After the war, you will come back."
"Oh,"
Madame Wisniak frowned, ran a hand through her tangled hair.
"Your children are French-born citizens," the policeman said. "You may leave them here. They're not on my list."
Isabel couldn't remain hidden. She got to her feet and descended the stairs to the landing.
"I'll take them for you, Lily," she said, trying to sound calm. "No!"
the children wailed in unison, clinging to their mother. The French policeman turned to her.
"What is your name?"
one of them asked Isabel. She froze. Which name should she give?
"Rossignol,"
she said at last, although without the corresponding papers it was a dangerous choice. Still, Gervaise might make them wonder why she was in this building at almost 3 in the morning, putting her nose in her neighbor's business. The policeman consulted his list and then waved her away.
"Go. You are no concern to me tonight."
Isabel looked past them to Lily Wisniak.
"I'll take the children, madame."
Lily seemed not to comprehend.
"You think I'll leave them behind?" "I think..."
"Enough,"
the older policeman yelled, thumping his rifle butt on the floor.
"You,"
he said to Isabel,
"get out. This doesn't concern you."
"Madame, please," Isabel pleaded. "I'll make sure they are safe."
"Safe?" Lily frowned.
"But we are safe with the French police. We've been assured. And a mother can't leave her children. Someday you'll understand."
She turned her attention to her children.
"Pack a few things."
The French policeman at Isabel's side touched her arm gently. When she turned, he said,
"Go."
She saw the warning in his eyes, but couldn't tell if he wanted to scare her or protect her.
"Now."
Isabel had no choice. If she stayed, if she demanded answers, sooner or later her name would be passed up to the prefecture of police, maybe even to the Germans. With what she and the network were doing with the escape route, and what her father was doing with false papers, she didn't dare draw attention. Not even for something as slight as demanding to know where a neighbor was being taken. Silently, keeping her gaze on the floor, she didn't trust herself to look at them. She eased past the policeman and headed for the stairs.